For War News Radio at Swarthmore College, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Tyler Welsh.
President Obama is removing Cuba from the U.S. State Sponsor of Terrorism list, a crucial step in plans to restore diplomatic ties announced in December. The State Department previously accused Cuba of harboring militants from Colombia and Spain, but now says there is no sign the Caribbean nation is arming terrorists. Cuba has been effectively locked out of financial markets for over 30 years because of its spot on the list. The island nation recently used its removal as a condition for reopening embassies. Congress has 45 days to appeal the president's announcement. Earlier this month, Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro met for the first time at the Summit of the Americas meeting in Panama. It was the first meeting of heads of state in more than 50 years.
The terrorist group Al-Shabaab staged an attack on the Somalian Ministry of Higher Education in Mogadishu this Tuesday. The attack started when a car laden with explosives blew a hole in the wall of the compound, into which Al-Shabaab gunmen streamed. The attack claimed the lives of at least 17 individuals, among them the ministry's head of security. 7 Al-Shabaab gunmen were also killed in the ensuing firefight. This killing comes in the wake of the group's deadliest attack to date, a massacre of over 150 students at a Kenyan university in Garissa 2 weeks ago.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani criticized the recent compromise between the Obama administration and Congress over the nuclear agreement with Iran. The compromise gives Congress the power of review over any agreement reached in negotiations and limits the lifting of sanctions. Many members of Congress fear that the current state of negotiations gives Iran too much freedom to potentially develop nuclear weapons. In criticizing the compromise between President Obama and Congress, Rouhani emphasized that Iran is negotiating with multiple countries, not just the United States. He called for greater respect and cooperation, including the lifting of pre-existing economic sanctions, in order for a deal to be reached.
Armed conflict between Ukrainian soldiers and pro-Russian rebels broke out near the rebel stronghold of Donetsk, despite the ceasefire agreement made on February 12th. The incident resulted in the highest death toll since the truce. Ukrainian and Russian foreign ministers met in Berlin on Monday and expressed grave concern about the rekindling of the conflict. Both parties agreed upon the withdrawal of heavy weaponry, as well as increased international monitoring of the ceasefire. The officials also established 4 working groups to facilitate for conversations between rebels, the Kiev government, and international representatives. The Wall Street Journal, however, notes key disagreements between Russia and Ukraine on the implementation of the Minsk deal, particularly the inclusion of rebel groups in the discussions regarding constitutional reform.
Following weeks of negotiations between diplomats from Persian Gulf states and Russia, the UN Security Council imposed an arms embargo on the Iran-backed Houthi fighters in Yemen. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will negotiate the distribution of humanitarian aid to Yemenis who have suffered from 3 weeks of Saudi-led airstrikes. The Gulf countries involved in the air campaign against the Houthis spearheaded the drafting of this resolution. Russia abstained from the vote on the resolution, favoring a ceasefire and an arms embargo that would affect both sides in the conflict. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power explained the rationale behind the embargo at the U.N. vote on Tuesday.
The Houthis, working in close coordination with former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, have intensified their military campaign, bombed Aden, and extended their offensive to Yemen's south. These actions have caused widespread violence and instability that threaten the security and welfare of the Yemeni people, as well as the region's security.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Power. The resolution calls on the Houthis to give up the areas they have seized in addition to their weapons. This week, a State Department official criticized Iran's military support to the Houthis, and the former American ambassador to Yemen expressed concern that Iran would take advantage of, quote, Houthi international isolation to expand its influence in Yemen.
400 migrants are believed to have died after their boat headed to Italy capsized off the coast of Libya. According to survivors, approximately 550 people were on board when the boat collapsed, only 24 hours after leaving Libya. The passengers were mostly from sub-Saharan Africa. The boat capsized as a result of passengers moving to one side of the boat after spotting a rescue ship. The Italian Coast Guard was able to rescue 144 people after conducting air and sea search operations. Italian authorities announced that they have rescued around 8,500 migrants in the last few days. The International Organization for Migration estimates up to 3,072 migrants have died crossing the Mediterranean in 2014, up threefold from 2013. Humanitarian agencies such as Amnesty International criticized the EU for having cut funding from rescue operations for migrants. Tragedies of this sort are expected to occur more frequently as analysts anticipate more migrants risking the journey to Europe in the spring and summer seasons.
A Colombian corporal and 10 soldiers were killed in an attack by rebels belonging to the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. FARC is a Marxist guerrilla group that has been fighting the Colombian government since 1964. In 2012, the rebel group began tenuous peace talks with the government. Last December, FARC declared a unilateral ceasefire. Up until the attack, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos had acknowledged that FARC was upholding the ceasefire. Following the attack, however, President Santos announced the resumption of a bombing campaign that had been suspended as part of the peace process. FARC members blamed the attack in the southwest province of Cauca on government instigation. President Santos has said he would not suspend the peace talks, insisting that acts of this nature and seriousness demonstrate once more the need to accelerate the negotiations to put an end to this conflict.
A couple of weeks ago, WNR reporter Amber Sheth had the opportunity to meet with Teresa Williamson, founder of Rio on Watch, a watchdog news organization that brings reporting directly from Rio favelas and translates it into English. Take a listen.
The city Rio de Janeiro brings to mind the sound of Brazilian samba music and tropical luxury. One thinks of beaches, plastic surgery, and suntans. The international spotlight has been on Rio since it gained the bid for the Olympics in 2016 and hosted the FIFA World Cup in 2014. However, popular media shows another, darker side in movies such as City of God, a crime-ridden and poverty-stricken city, the place you would want to avoid if you're a foreign tourist. How can these two views of Rio be reconciled? According to popular American news sources, the epicenter of Rio's non-tourist-friendly areas are the favelas, low-cost neighborhoods that comprise a large portion of the city. News outlets such as Fox and CNN would have you believe that the favelas are slums, representative of urban poverty at its worst. Demolishing this sort of stereotype is part of the work that activist Teresa Williamson does with the nonprofit she founded in 2000, Catalytic Communities. I was able to meet with Teresa and hear her talk about the misconceptions about favelas and the work that she's done with Catalytic Communities. She began with dispelling Western-produced views about favelas. First and foremost, they are communities, some of which have existed since the 1800s. They are almost entirely built by the residents and their families, but this does not mean that they are unstable or temporary structures. In fact, families can trace their history through the construction of their homes within a favela, and often this history allows for the passing down of building techniques, such as building on the sides of hills. Favelas often have strong community leadership and act as cultural incubators for art forms such as capoeira, samba, and Brazilian funk. And crime, although present in some communities, is not as widespread throughout the favelas as American news outlets say. In fact, nowadays, many of these communities are very safe and thus are attracting wealthier buyers, expelling the original residents. So Rio's favelas definitely aren't the sort of impoverished shantytowns as they are often described. However, there are some points of conflict between the communities and city policy. That's where Teresa Williamson comes in. The nonprofit that she founded as part of her doctoral dissertation research, Catalytic Communities, works in, around, and with the favelas of Rio to connect these communities with each other and the global community. Most recently, CatCom has branched out to form a new offshoot, Rio on Watch. It stands for Rio Olympics Neighborhood Watch, and acts as a watchdog news source covering stories as they develop directly in the favelas. Here's Teresa on the beginnings of Rio on Watch.
The very, very first intent was to have communities learn how to use WordPress. It was literally a test site we created during our strategic social media trainings in 2010, where community leaders could just go on the back end and play around and publish stories. And actually, the very first couple stories on Rio on Watch, if you go back, you'll see, are those stories. But what happened was we also did have the vision that this could be a useful tool for reporting on Rio through the Olympics, which is why we named it Rio Olympics Neighborhood Watch.
Rio on Watch grew to cover heavier issues associated with the Olympics and World Cup. Teresa recounted a story during her lecture about how favela residents were being evicted by the city in order to build a parking lot for a World Cup stadium. The presence of Rio on Watch reporters helped the residents to get better terms for the eviction, and they ended up being offered homes in a neighborhood nearby rather than being sent to public housing miles away from their places of work and school. The parking lot was never completed, and the neighborhood is still rubble today. There's this disconnect between the favela residents and the city government of Rio. There's so much money being funneled into the city, and it's not being put to the best use. Initiatives to work with favela leaders fall flat and leave residents mistrustful of the government. Police violence becomes exacerbated as the city attempts to offer greater security in the favelas. Rio on Watch covers these and more issues surrounding the favelas, and has succeeded in helping to focus media attention where it's needed, rather than perpetuating stereotypes about the favelas. This is accomplished by getting reports directly from favela residents and translating them into English, so they can be received by a wider audience. A new service was also recently launched, called Rio on Wire, a Twitter account that caters to journalists coming to Rio with no previous knowledge of Brazil, so they can get minute-by-minute updates of big stories. The entrepreneurship that Teresa Williamson has initiated is exciting, because her small nonprofit has done a great deal to change perceptions about favelas. But any large-scale change to improve conditions within the favela communities will have to come from the government. I asked Teresa what the city of Rio could do to work with the residents.
Well, favelas, because they've been left to their own devices for so much of their history, they've developed their own ways of organizing, and residents have essentially built them to the point they're at, which is not ideal, but there's a lot of quality development going on in favelas. So what the government needs to do is to come in, obviously, and be responsible and be present and bring in missing services.
Teresa also notes that the favelas need some degree of independence.
Has been actively organizing their community because they're building their own homes. They're changing the layout. They're changing the structure. It's very organic. And so everybody should be brought to the table.
Will that happen? It's unclear if Rio de Janeiro will stray from its history of working against, rather than with, the favelas. But Rio on Watch will continue to follow these developments as the 2016 Olympics approach. For War News Radio, I'm Amber Sheth.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Leo Elliott, Amy DiPiero, Joseph Millman, Catherine Kwok, Nemat Kaur, Sabrina Merrill, John Gagnon, Evan Grennan, and Amber Sheth. This week's show was produced by Joelle Hajboutros. I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Tyler Welsh. Until next time, thanks for listening.